I think we can get started. My name is Paul Rohde. I'm stirring our conversation this month about pilgrimage. And when I'm not at Holden Village, I'm campus pastor at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. And I'm on sabbatical this year, so able to stay for a month. And very grateful that you're interested and willing to think about what pilgrimage may mean. One of the reasons I'm passionately interested in this is that I travel a good bit with students. Service learning on our campus is coordinated through the chapel, and so I travel over the country and, as you'll see, parts of the world with students, and I'm very interested in helping them articulate and integrate, so not only engage the experience, but by means of a journal, by means of discussion, by means of a theology that undergirds pilgrimage as practice, to help them be more reflective and more clear about what the experience might mean for the rest of their lives. And that for the rest of us, too. One of the things I love about teaching here is that it really does become a conversation and a dialogue. And so I've had some questions from last night that I'm going to respond to. First, I will tell you about this book. Ian Bradley was my teacher in Scotland when we were at Iona. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture of him. And he put this book out last summer. I will have it with me a lot this month if you'd like to take a look at it. The first half of it is history and theology of pilgrimage, and the second half is a fairly detailed description of 12 or 13 pilgrimage sites around Europe. And he talks not only about the heritage of the site and the history and why it's significant, but he gives some practical data about if you want to go there, how to get there, and where it's at, and how to make connections, and the website addresses. And lots of pictures. It's sort of a coffee table book. It's really a wonderful resource. Last night, I started out saying some things about pilgrimage as a practice. And by that, I mean to say it's not merely that we're here trying to get a theological definition of what a pilgrimage is, but that we would hope that pilgrimage would be something that we would live into and toward and be identifying as we go. In what we're calling post-enlightenment or modernity or whatever you want to call that chapter in our thinking, definition and action were often separated. And one of the things a view of Christian practices is trying to do is bring those back together. Several people asked me some questions about more of what that means. Let's see if I can find some light. This is one of my all-time favorite quotations by Miroslav Volf, who teaches at Yale, in the preface to Theology for a Way of Life. "My contention," he says, "is that at the heart of every good theology lies not simply a plausible intellectual vision, but more importantly, a compelling account of a way of life, and that theology is therefore best done from within the pursuit of this way of life." So that is to say that Christianity is first and foremost a life, and theology is offered as reflection in support of that life. Now, my other favorite quotation is Martin Luther's, who says, "A drunk can fall off a horse on two sides." Maybe the only thing worse than reflecting and not acting is acting and not reflecting. This is not to limit or diminish the importance of definition or reflection or any of those kinds of things. The Valparaiso Institute on the formation of Christian faith has done a lot of work in practices, and Craig Dykstra from the Lilly Foundation is very involved with that. So Dorothy Bass, in a preface to one of his books, wrote this: "Too often it has been assumed that those in Christian education emphasize the how of helping one another to live the life of Christian faith. Well, what does it mean becomes the exclusive domain of the theologians. In all of his work, Craig Dykstra has challenged this facile and ultimately debilitating division. He insists that thinking and doing cannot be separated, and neither can believing and living, education and its content, or theology and the means of sharing it with others. This is where practices come in. Not at all through a simplistic putting ideas into practice approach, but rather by showing how the dualism implied in that cliche disappears when people are actively engaged in the ongoing thought-filled practices of the Christian faith. I've got a hilarious example of this. A friend of mine has a son who is 50 years old and became a parent for the first time this summer. So they have a brand new baby. The son happens to be a psychologist and has made a career out of teaching parenting classes. Well, now he's 50 and a parent for the first time. So they brought the baby home from the hospital, and they had a video camera, and they thought, well, good, we'll get some footage about how to put a baby to sleep. Well, they decided that they wouldn't keep the footage from the first night. And by the second night, they gave up on footage altogether and called Grandma to come. But you hear what we're after. That does not invalidate parenting classes in any way. To learn to think critically about that important relationship is very helpful. But thinking critically about it cannot be separated from the moment that you are face-to-face with the child. Similarly, with pilgrimage as a practice, I thought one of the reasons it might be fun to think about it here is that everybody who's here has left somewhere to get here. They have departed. We are on a journey. And so from the midst of that, then to be reflecting on how it is that journeying, traveling, makes us more conscious of the presence of God. Check my notes. For some who may not have been able to be here last night, and just for review for those who were, to think of the beginning of pilgrimage, I like to simply use the word go, or leave, or put them together and say let go. Sometime in this conversation, I want us to tell departure stories. And the kinds of departure stories we will tell will be very different than the ones that go smoothly. It'll be clear that there's more going on than geography. You're letting go of something, losing a sense of what the world, what you may have thought the world was like or yourself was like. As I talk about Iona, well, I guess I'm going to talk about Taizé first, and then talk a little bit about Iona, and John is going to show us some slides from the Camino in Spain. I invite you to listen for what is being let go, what is being left behind. And then the other thing I tried to talk about last night is the end of pilgrimage, also not so much being geographic destination, but a sense of the sacramental presence of God, that God is present and revealed in earthly means. And one of the reasons I think travel is valuable is that it opens our eyes, it heightens our senses, and we become more aware. So I will no doubt offer some thoughts. I'm sure John will have some thoughts about the Camino, and we can listen for that. Before I begin, just for a sense of timing, I wanted to ask if there are folks who've been to other pilgrimage sites who would like a few minutes in this conversation to talk about them. Anybody here been to Assisi? Oh, we've got some Assisi folks. Then probably Rome, too. Cities of Paul or Churches of Revelation in Turkey. Okay. Any other?
Jerusalem.
Okay. Great. Well, before we're done, we'll have a little travel fair. We'll look at a few pictures. And then I'll be interested in your comparisons with some of these other sites. This is actually a shot of Cluny, which was a medieval pilgrimage site. Bernard was a Benedictine who initiated monastic reform and brought a large number of the monasteries of Central Europe under his influence. And so Cluny, there was the church in Cluny is in ruins, but you see some of the arches that stand. And there's a map there that describes how big it was. There were up to 10,000 pilgrims a year who went to Cluny in the height of the Middle Ages. Another shot of Cluny. In 1940, Brother Roger, who was a Swiss Lutheran, was looking for a home and a place to locate a community, and took a detour through Cluny just to see the pilgrimage site, and then ended up staying in Taizé, which is a small French town in the Burgundy, a very small town. I would say probably numbers a few hundred people. And found great hospitality there, found an affordable home, and began a house there to give refuge to folks, to practice hospitality, and particularly, I said 1940, that's an important detail, Jewish refugees who are seeking safety and asylum. And that becomes an important part of what has then since become the order of Tezé, or the community of Tezé, because hospitality, welcome, and reconciliation among people of faith is a major emphasis of the community of Tezé. Brother Roger tragically was murdered in evening prayer. In the community was in worship in 2005, I think. August of 2005. Yeah. His wish was that the daily rhythms of the community would continue without interruption. So if you can imagine this group of monks, which has grown to a number about 100 monks, lost their founding prior in worship the night before, got up in the morning and started morning prayer and the daily Bible study, and the rhythms continued. 2 years later, the ELCA campus pastors went as a colleague group, and it was apparent that they are still working through his loss. You could see a liminal space coming, a threshold coming on right here. They practice hospitality to people from all over the world. And one of the things that makes Tezé very exciting and a little challenging is that there are gazillions of languages spoken. The week we were there, there were about 4,000 people speaking 50 languages. They don't plan for the translation. They do it spontaneously. Well, I'll talk about that when I get to the Bible study. The center of life at Tezé is worship. These bells call the community to prayer three times a day, 8:30, 12:30, and 8:30. And prayer is held in this church. The community has felt a calling particularly to reach out to Christians in Eastern Europe, hence the onion domes, often associated with Orthodoxy. The church has expanded through the years as more and more people flock to Tezé. You can't get the brothers to give an answer. Can you see okay? Am I standing in your way?
No, it's good.
Okay. As more and more people flock to Tezé, if you ask the brothers, why are so many people drawn to Tezé, they will turn the question back and say, why do you think so many people are drawn to Tezé? And the mystery remains a mystery. So the part on the right was the original church, and then as they've added these modules, they divide them with electric garage doors. So the community, it ranges from 40 or 50 guests in the lowest times up to 5,000 at various points, and then they can electrically lift these garage doors. This is the inside. It's very simple. The stools here in the center. Oh, this is so high tech. I can hardly believe I can hold it. Isn't that impressive? Well, that's actually the keyboard. And then the brothers sit there in the center. Of course, we can't take pictures during prayer. I think one of the reasons, I'll just tell you that I went to Tezé and Iona because there are communities in the world that most remind me of Holden. And I'm interested in claiming some of those comparisons. But one of the differences at Tezé to Holden is that here we emphasize that everybody who comes is community. Tezé, it's very clear that at the center of this is a community of brothers. And then we are in community with them. Another difference is that in worship, nobody stands in front. So that God is the leader of worship, and all the rest of us are guests in God's presence. One of Tezé's contributions to the world has been the chants that are the center of their prayer. You know, Jesus, remember me, for example, that is a Tezé chant. And so the worship is very simple. We chant the prayers repeatedly. I was there with some college students. One of them admitted to distraction, and the night we did prayer around the cross on Friday evenings here at Holden is patterned after Tezé worship. That's where the inspiration was given. Counted 91 times through Jesus, remember me. And then there's reading of scripture, psalm, and an alleluia response, reading of scripture. and a substantial amount of silence, usually 15 to 20 minutes, when the community sits in silence. One of the things that's thrilling about being in the community is to hear and feel the silence deepen as the week goes on. I think for a lot of people, it's one of those places of real discomfort when you first come. But that deepens as the week goes on. Another really interesting thing about the whole program at Tezay is that they call themselves a pilgrimage of trust on earth. And they give no announcements or instruction. They just figure that people will get what they need and people will figure it out. And so you participate as you participate. And it's a little disconcerting at first. It's also really beautiful for the kind of focus it gives. Icons, also a gift from the East, are very present in worship. So we started with the center of the day, which is worship three times a day, prayer. And then after morning prayer and breakfast, there is a Bible study. This is Brother Pedro, who's leading the Bible study in our tent. The brothers have maintained a focus on young adults as the center of their ministry. And so anybody over 30 is segregated, and we eat and have our own Bible study and our own discussion groups in a different tent on the grounds. Then the young adults are at a different tent. We've been there once without young adults and once with young adults and learned a good bit about the difference of the experience. So in our Bible introduction, I told you they don't plan the translation, but this woman here is translating into German. There's another slide coming. This guy there is translating into Spanish. The F stands for Francais. They say the Bible study is presented in Tezay English because it's the language that most people can translate the most easily. So the Bible study happens a sentence at a time. It's spoken in English, and then each of these translators ripples it through the crowd, up to 40 times. I'm convinced it's as close to Pentecost as we can get. And then there's time for small group discussion. This is Susan. Remember, you recognize Susan? And her small group that was in discussion the first time we went. These people are from Washington, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of around the grounds are these small benches set up for folks to have conversation. After the Bible study, then there's a time of silence. And all of the Bible study groups are given tasks. So these, again, are some people from Susan's group whose task it was to serve lunch?
Dinner.
Doing dishes is another one of the tasks that all the participants will participate in. The community eats in solidarity with the poor. So this is breakfast. A hard roll with some jam and a cup. And then I don't think I brought a picture. Well, no, I didn't bring a picture. Whoops. You get a cup and then there are pails of instant cocoa, instant coffee, instant tea, dried milk. And the challenge is to get mocha by the end of the week, you know, to do whatever arrangement of this. Once you've been to Tezay, you know to supplement a bit.
Yeah.
So you see some protein for breakfast and fruit, and I bring some coffee, bags. There's another group doing their chores. Okay, that's Scotland. Any questions, comments about Tezay?
How long? Like, is there a minimum amount of time you have to stay, one full week, or...?
You can stay for any amount of time you want. But the typical stay is a week, Sunday to Sunday. Most people arrive on a Sunday and leave again on a Sunday.
Do they have a website?
Yes, they do. And I got that. I can give that to you if you're interested.
Okay.
If you just search Tezay Community.
How do you spell it?
T-A-I-Z-E. T-A-I-Z-E.
Besides the brothers, is there a permanent community of maintenance people or whatever?
No, there are volunteers who come for up to 6 months at a time. Okay. Do that. The The brothers are completely self-supporting. They don't accept any contributions. They charge only a nominal fee to cover expenses for the guests. And then they participate in crafts. They make a lot of pottery, some textiles, record the music, publish the music, publish books, cards, icons. And so there is an atelier where you can buy their goods, and that's how the community supports itself. There's also a community of women that has attached themselves to the ministry, and they participate in Ministry of Hospitality. Another option that guests at Tizay have is to keep a week in silence, and there is segregated housing for the silence. This would be one of the obstacles if we do a little... I guess I didn't say this to everybody. When I get off the Holden board, I'm inclined someday to do a tour of Iona and Tizay among Holden folks so that we could all make comparisons and offer comparisons. I think there's a lot that we can learn from each other as centers for Christian renewal around the globe. One of the obstacles to doing that is that they are very particular about registering groups over 30, over age 30. If you're an individual or a couple over 30, you can go to the website and register without a problem. But if I, as a group organizer, wanted to bring a group of folks who would be over 30, that would be a challenge. Nancy?
And it's still true also that if you're over 30, you cannot go for more than a week a year.
I think that is true. Yeah.
And is it the brothers that lead the Bible study?
Yes.
So they don't wear habits?
No.
Just in worship?
White shirt.
They wear albs, prayer robes in worship.
And why is there such a stipulation over 30?
They want to keep the focus of their ministry on young adults. And their fear is that adults will dominate the discussion, and they want young adults to have that freedom to interact with each other. It made us very grateful for all the ways that Holden is intergenerational. I would not encourage Holden to adopt that model at all. As I think about our kids growing up out here, and how powerful it was for them to know people of every age and interact with them. Be welcome into all the sessions and us welcome into all the things they were doing. One of the things that occurred to me as I was thinking about liminal spaces and sacramental moments is how much the same they were. That the awkwardness around that diversity of people is a real challenge. And you really have to work at discussion and understanding, comprehension. Some of that is really good because you can't use any jargon. You have to bring everything you say into the concrete and make it translatable. That's also clearly one of the ways that God is present in folks who are coming with diverse experiences. My small group got off the discussion on a tangent one day when I was there this summer and started talking about the problem of immigration. There were people there from Italy, Germany, England, and the United States, and it was so fascinating to hear the similarity in attempting to be just and compassionate in living with neighbors who come across our borders. Any other questions?
I was just going to say that my experience this year was pretty frustrating the first day or so in the discussion group. I was the only American, and it was difficult for people to have a connection to be able to translate so that everyone could understand. But I stuck with it, and every day it got better. And by the end of the week, you know, we were taking pictures just like middle school kids do at Bible camp, you know, exchanging addresses, and there were some real connections that were made just because we stuck it out and risked a little bit more, and it became very, very meaningful.
I found a quote. Brother Alloy is the successor to Brother Roger, and I found a quotation by him that I wanted to offer because I thought it was beautifully descriptive, both of the community of Tizay and of pilgrimage. Our life is living our humanity in the presence of God, not finding our spirituality floating in the clouds. And the teachers, this was in the description of Tizay, the teachers deliberately focus their teaching on the tension between prayer and contemplation and the struggles of faith and our responsibility in the world. And you can sense some of that even in the lifestyle, eating in solidarity with the poor and so on. So, we'll quickly go north. We are now on the coast of Scotland. This is Oban on the northwest side of Scotland. I read a quotation last night from a pilgrim who had gone there and reflected on all the means of transportation. From Glasgow, you fly to Glasgow to get here, and then take a train or a bus to Oban, which is on the coast. And then you board a ferry. This is still Oban. Oban is a delightful coastal town. And the island that you see, well, these are the Inner Hebrides, for sake of geography. Yeah, okay. I guess I didn't have any of a riding on Mull. About a 45-minute ferry ride to the island of Mull, and then it's an hour and a half bus ride across the island of Mull.
And on a narrow one-lane road.
Yeah. You've been there.
I did.
Yeah. They also have a website, search Iona Community, and print the instructions and follow it step by step, and you'll be just fine. And it's all timed out so that the buses leave after the ferry gets there. There are no lags here, but it is a long, barren trek. And there's really nothing but sheep on Mull. So these are
people.
A few. Way more sheep.
Yeah.
And so these are the folks. And then from there, it's just about a 5 or 10 minute ferry ride over to Iona. That is the ferry right there. This is Mull. So you see, it's just a little tiny strait. The island is only 3.5 miles long by 1.5 miles wide. It's very small. This is the abbey, which dates to the 13th century. The Columba, this is important in Scottish faith because St. Columba left Ireland, vowed never to return to Ireland in 563 AD, came to Iona, and from the island of Iona converted the country of Scotland. The Celts were missionary pilgrims all across the land of Scotland. And so historically and culturally it's important, as well as religiously. But nothing remains of Columba's monastery now. The one that's there was rebuilt in the 13th century. In 1938, George MacLeod, who was a very dynamic, charismatic pastor in the Church of Scotland, took seminarians out and began restoring the abbey and then founded what is called the Iona Community. So the Iona Community is not a community that lives on Iona, as the Holden Community is not just people who live at Holden. The Iona Community are new monastics, an ecumenical group that lives by a rule, and they are international. They have members and partners all over the world. So pilgrims to Iona can stay at the abbey. This is a picture of the abbey. We were able to stay there. This is part of the 13th century road that is still left there. This is St. Martin's Cross, erected in honor of St. Martin of Tours. This over here is the church. It's very sparse, raw stone interior. But the acoustics are fabulous. And the Iona community is also really prominent in global Christianity for the music it's contributed. The music of John Bell, who is the songwriter, has contributed many wonderful songs and chants. St. Martin's Cross again and again. That's a better view of the church. I think they had room for about 75 folks. About half of them stayed here at the
90.
Was it 90? And there were about 40 here then, and then 50 over at the MacLeod Center. They built a second building in the 1980s, and they called it the MacLeod Center, and it's maybe a block up from the church.
Some people just come and stay in a motel.
Right.
Or at B&Bs on the island too, and then they come to the church for worship. Can participate in other events as well.
250,000 pilgrims a year, pilgrims and or tourists, come to Iona, about 1,500 a day. And so they are, that ferry is bringing them constantly. Most people stay less than a day. Again, if you stay for a week, there is a program that runs for a week here. There are some other retreat centers on the island. This is the cloister of the abbey, and a sculpture that commemorates the descent of the Holy Spirit, that's a dove, into the womb of Mary. The thing that we're going to spend a little more time on this month, when we start acting pilgrimage, the thing that's so wonderful at Iona is that every Tuesday, anybody who wants to, that is the folks staying at the Abbey as well as anybody who's on the island, is invited to a walking pilgrimage around the island. They have two of them. The 7-hour one is an off-road pilgrimage, or there's a 2-hour one that's an on-road pilgrimage. But they both start here at St. Martin's Cross. And they give us a picture of the sort of attentiveness and reflection that I think is at least characteristic, if not definitive, of a pilgrimage. So we started here with meditations on St. Martin. And then this is the ruins of the nunnery. This is the current leader of the Iona community. And at each stop, he would give a bit of interpretation about the historic importance of what we were seeing. Then he would offer scripture or a poem or a song or a prayer. Well, scripture, poem, or song. And then in several instances, we were invited to a time of silence, and then we prayed together. The nunnery, the reflection was about the historic disparity between men and women. You notice that the abbey has been beautifully restored, and the nunnery stands in ruins. There are meticulous records about what the ministry of the monks was, and we know almost nothing about the ministry of the women, who lived closer to the village, who no doubt were involved in very significant ways. So that he read a great poem, and maybe sometime this week I'll read the poem. I still remember. It's called And God Said Yes. It's a wonderful, wonderful poem. We were invited to walk in silence through the nunnery and think about women who have been significant in our walk of faith and give thanks for them. Another picture of the nunnery. Iona is a photographer's dream. The light is splendid. This shows us then, we've left the village behind. Right down here, there is one, maybe it's there, there's one intersection on the island. So there are two roads and they manage one intersection. So when we get there, we reflected on intersections in our lives. Here we're starting to get up into the bogs. And so we learn how to walk across a bog, and it is short steps fast. Learning how to walk becomes a tangible experience of discipleship. Susan said, why on earth did they put the bogs at the beginning of the pilgrimage? We're going to have wet feet. Well, they put the bogs at every part of the pilgrimage. And we did indeed have wet feet.
It just got deeper and wider.
The impulse is to try to jump across. It looks like a puddle. But then you go through. And they can be as much as knee deep, and people lose their shoes in them.
Well, sometimes it just looks like grass.
Yeah.
You know, when I went in, and I thought I was walking on grass, and suddenly it was the end over my
ankles. Did you take the pilgrimage? Were you there on a Tuesday?
No.
This is the quarry. There's a marble altar in the church that was quarried. And one of the things that's remembered here is the endurance of the earth, because the rocks on Iona are some of the oldest rocks in the world, and the way they're threatened by humanity. You get down below and you see this. Does this look familiar? They mined the marble and then they just left the stuff behind. You might notice that the wind is coming up. There is nothing between the Greenland and this little island. This is the Bay of Columba, where it's believed that Columba landed, or at least where the landing of Columba is commemorated. And so it's a place to reflect on new beginnings. I think I told the folks last night, we picked up one stone and threw it in the ocean. as a gesture for something we want to leave behind. And then we're invited to take a second stone with us to remember that we did it. Lunch. It's another place you stop and reflect on the importance of water. You climb these knolls. Golf was, of course, invented in Scotland. There is a golf course. They said it was invented by a shepherd who was bored and hit a rock with his staff. And the rest is history. So here we reflect about recreation, the importance of recreation. The beaches on Iona are stunning, though the water is frigid. The Hebrides, you may know some about the Hebrides if you know Mendelssohn's Hebridean Symphony. It was inspired by the island of Staffa, which is about a 3-4 hour ferry ride from Iona, but the water was too high for us to go across. I just got a few shots of landscape and beaches. I was very taken with the starkness of the landscape. It's the kind of beauty that grows on you. One of the things that characterizes Celtic theology is a more deliberate integration of creation and redemption in every part of their worship and life. So one of the things that Second Article Christians tend to be critical of that is fear of being romantic about nature. I don't think there'd be any way to be romantic about nature here. It was so stark and harsh. We're back at Clooney. John, pull your slides up while people ask questions about Iona. I didn't talk so much about the rhythm of the day. There was morning and evening prayer at Iona. Three meals. Provided, and then lectures given. In that, the teaching ministry was really quite similar.
Did you do the 2 hour or the 7 hour?
We did the 7 hour. Yeah.
Wow. So you'd miss a lot of that if you did the 2 hour.
You would miss a lot of it. You wouldn't go on any blogs. Yeah. Okay. John is going to take us to Spain.
Yes, we're going to Spain. So last summer, in June, I was in Spain. I was there with my college orchestra and decided to stay afterwards and do part of this pilgrimage route called El Camino de Santiago in Spain. Although it comes up from, there are probably 10 different routes you can take to get to Santiago, where St. James is buried. And that's the site for which people pilgrim to see. And I went with my sister, Martha. This is the first slide, which I'll talk about, because it has this shell on it, which is a very important symbol on the pilgrimage. I've read lots of different things about why it's, what it symbolizes, why it's a symbol. I'll name just a couple I think are interesting. Where's that? Oh, there it is. All right. So one is that people say it symbolizes the many different paths that one takes to get to the end. So you see all of these different, it's a shell, you know, it's a, what's the kind of shell? Scallop shell, thank you. So that's one. Another is that pilgrims, when on the journey, and this was all started, as story goes, by St. James, he would take this shell and just use that for receiving food and water and hospitality from people that he met along the road. So he'd only take so much as could be filled by a single shell. Another one, a little more of a stretch, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Paul, but I do think that this shell in the Catholic tradition is a symbol of baptism. So insofar as this reminds us of our baptism, we are reminded of our baptism probably every 15 yards or so, because the whole way is marked by this. And so that was good. I got a shell. Every pilgrim has a shell that they put on their pack so you can identify who the pilgrims are. And I think I brought it with me. I couldn't find it. If I do find it, I'll bring it to a future session. Leave with it. So, yeah, so that's the shell. Do I do that? Okay, this is just a little picture I took because the first day of the pilgrimage, you know, we were expecting, you know, we're
backpacking in Europe. There's going to be great scenery. And most of the first day, because we started in Lyon, most of the first day was walking slowly out of a city. So we hit, you know, the industrial area and the highways just beyond that, and run down furniture stores kind of on the outskirts. And this was probably the most scenic thing that we saw that whole first day. A few cows there on the left, a nice gravel road instead of a paved one, which is what we walked on most of the time. So that was the first day. And a lot of, you know, a lot of the way is, you know, maybe parallel to a highway, or it runs through cities and towns that aren't very picturesque, but it just kind of, this path just ended up there. And so that's where you pilgrim. And it after a while, kind of gets a certain charm about it, I think. You know, and you see a lot of different kinds of cities. This is the first refugio that we stayed in, or albergue is another word. Pilgrim hostel is what you would call them in English. They're marked by it's more artistic rendition of the shell. This is my sister, and this is a more simple one. Very simple housing. The first one we stayed at actually was in a monastery in Lyon, and there are enough monasteries along the way that you probably pass one every other day or so. And most of the monasteries provide bedding for free. They ask for maybe a donation, but they'll feed you very simple meals similar to what we saw in Taizé. And they'll also have like huge bunk houses, so it's you know, separated by sex. So the first night when we stayed at a monastery, I stayed in a room with probably 60 beds with people all from all around the world, snoring and turning over and getting up to leave at different times in the morning. We were usually the last to leave of the people staying where we were staying. This was another model, though, very quaint, very small, maybe two or three people to a room. And these ones, you usually paid like maybe 3 or 4 euros a night, and they would also feed you pretty good food. So, moving along, there's a lot of this kind of scenery, few trees, power lines in the distance, barn. It was pretty cloudy and rainy when we were on it as well. It was just coming out of they're just starting to get the summer heat at that point, but there's still a fair amount of wetness. These are the kinds of posts that you would see all along the way that marked it. This is one of the larger towns that we went through with this long bridge. Again, you go through these towns probably every few kilometers, although only a few of them have options as far as places to stay. So it's interesting because, you know, I think a fair amount of people want to do this kind of pilgrimage in solitude. You do see a lot of people traveling, walking by themselves. But inevitably, you end up kind of with the same people all the way because, you know, you have to decide, do I want to walk 12 miles today or 25 miles today, because that's the distance between albergues. So if you make a lot of the same decisions that other people in your particular group end up making, which is inevitable on a lot of days, you see the same exact people staying at every single place. And you maybe roll in at different times, but you greet each other, and most of the albergues have, they serve meals around a common table, so you eat with them, and then you walk separately the next day, but then you see them when you get there, so you get to know some familiar faces that way. Here's another town that we walked through. They had a lot of crosses along the way. People put up just homemade ones, or this is like maybe a slightly fancier one, commemorating people, or you know, maybe just an individual wants to mark
their own pilgrimage or passage through the place, so they'll put something up. I'm not exactly sure what this one was for, but not an uncommon sight on the way. This was a little bit of, kind of reminded me of our Holden Hilarity touch on the way. It said, you know, leave your pilgrimage flair here, kind of. And there's a statue of this pilgrim, and people just leave all kinds of crazy things. Like, I don't know who does a pilgrimage with the boa, but it got there, and they left it around his neck, you know. And, you know, shoes. You see a lot of shoes. People must bring in multiple pairs and decide, you know, once one's worn out, you just leave it. So that's another thing, is we brought too much stuff. Our own experiences of backpacking, mostly that have happened here at Holden, require us to bring, you know, just always be prepared. That's not the right attitude to come with on this kind of walk, because, you know, if you need to dry things out or wash them, you can do it at albergues. Other than that, you maybe need a sleeping bag, an extra pair of shoes, and that's pretty much all you'll need. Everything else you pick up along the way or you rely on finding along the way from other people that you might encounter. We were way too prepared, and it really, we felt it on our backs, you know. Mm-hmm. So, less stuff next time. Another kind of scenic rolling pasture area I went through. This is at another albergue that we stayed at.
John, if I remember right, you said that you didn't make reservations or anything. You just
no reservations.
Got there,
you walk
right?
in, although it's like
first
it is
come,
first
serve.
Come first serve. So they have to start refusing people if they get to a certain size. A lot of the monasteries won't do that, like the religiously affiliated ones. It's just this ethic of hospitality that's a little just kind of no questions asked. You can stay here. But most of the ones that you find are privately owned. People set them up and just run it. It's a little family business. And you don't feel like they're like in it for money or anything. I think they probably make just enough to break even. But they do, you know, reject people if they need to. So you gotta make sure you get there in a semi-timely manner. Here's some, sometimes there'll be places to refill water along the way. So that's a shot of that. This is actually, this and the next few slides are the views that you would get. This was the highest point of the pilgrimage that we were on. That was in Spain. I think in France it's higher. It actually starts in France. This it's called the Via Française that we were on, and it starts in France. But in Spain, then it gets very low, and there's not a whole lot of altitude change except for a little up in the middle. And this is kind of at the top of that up. And this is at the very top of that up. It's this tall cross. It's commemorative of a cross that was on the original pilgrimage route. It started in, I think, the 9th century is when people discovered, you know, St. James's body is here, and this is how we can get there. And so pilgrims started going. So it's been going for a long time. The original cross, which is not at the top, but it's commemorating that cross. It is in a museum somewhere. But this is a place where it's a major gathering spot. People leave all kinds of things on this. There are little, you know, ID cards, prayers, pieces of cloth that, you know, represent more shoes again. You see more shoes down here. People just, people, you know, bring things ahead of time, knowing that there are opportunities to leave things at the foot of the cross along the way. One woman that we met at this point, she was in tears because this was the end of her pilgrimage. She considered this the end, although she did go the rest of the way. She started, as a lot of Europeans start, from her front door in Holland. They just leave from their house, and that's where it starts. And they walk from there to the path that is traveled by a lot of people. And then when she got here, that was the end. And it was quite an adventure for her. So, a lot of very, you know, progressive wind technology here by the Spaniards. You see lots of these, you know, very Don Quixote wind fields. there's that same cross kind of looking up at it. Very thick, lush foliage along the way. Here's another, like, this isn't the kind of little mountain hillside town that you would walk through a lot. Go back a couple. Sometimes you do actually walk on the street. A lot of people bike the pilgrimage. That's an option now. And they stay on the street the whole way. And they do it in much shorter amounts of time. It usually takes a little over a month to do the whole thing. This particular route from France, bikers can do it in, you know, a week or two. If they're, you get a lot of really seasoned bikers. This is, took a picture. One of the guys we ended up with walking, I think we walked with him for a couple days, two or three days. His name was Dan. And he was the only other American that we found along the way too, from Texas, deployed to Afghanistan, ended up being discharged for, I think he was found to be narcoleptic. So then he was looking for a next thing, and he was doing the Camino between being deployed, or being discharged, and the next thing for him was moving to a Buddhist monastery in India, where he was going to train to be a Buddhist spiritual director. So he was very much, you know, seeking and on the road alone, but very, very social, very kind person, petting a sheepdog that came across us. This is one of the larger monastery albergues that we found. You know, I think there were a few levels of 80 bunks that were here, a major resting point for pilgrims. This is an example of a smaller one. You know, very quaint, you know, family-run places. Another town. Okay, and then here's the end. We did about 200 kilometers in the middle, and then because we didn't have time to get all the way there, and we avoided the last 100 kilometers because in order to get your Compostela, is what it's called, it's like a certificate of completion, which is the thing. When you see people getting their Compostelas in Santiago, it's a very emotional time for them. And in order to be eligible for that, you only need to walk the 100 kilometers of it. So people in the summer, they figure what the town is 100 kilometers from the end, and they start there. So you get a lot more traffic through there. And we decided to hike kind of a higher, more scenic, further away section. And then we hopped on a bus and went the rest of the way just to see what all the hype was about. This is the cathedral, very big, very ornate. There's my sister and I, and me. You get in there, it's very, you know, big, very ornate, very Catholic. The tomb of Santiago is right below that altar. We did, you know, we are wait in line to go down and see it. We ended up down there with a group of Russian men that said the Lord's Prayer together in Russian and filled the whole, like, you know, cavern with their prayer. It was kind of a claustrophobic experience, very tight, and it's just this little, you know, this box, you know, it's like 6 feet, and this is what people are coming to see. And So that was, I mean, that was cool. A few other things. Obviously, you know, we encountered people from all around the world on our trek. Buen Camino, kind of loosely translated to happy trails, is what you would greet everybody with on the road. And we met South Africans, Australians, Europeans, mostly French, I would say, is like the most traveled country of origin. Not very many Americans. And yeah, I mean, we made some good relations, created some good bonds with people that we were with most of the way. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I would like to do the whole thing. I've learned some valuable things about traveling it that I would use for next time if I'm going to do a full month of it. But yeah, it's quite a trek.
Great.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions about the Camino? For time.
So how many days did you spend on?
I spent about 8. So just a very abbreviated portion of the pilgrimage.
So there were more French than Spanish people, even though it's in Spain?
Yeah, that was what we found. Mm-hmm. Spanish, though, if you know some Spanish, that goes a long way, because I think that was even more of, you know, in Teze they said it was English for in Bible studies. If you know some Spanish, it takes you a little further, I think, than English. But people do know some English, obviously.
So in this case, there wasn't any formal instruction or guidance or anything. It's just, mm-mm, you're just walking and you're
right
on your own to gather what you can.
Yep, you get, when you start, or at whatever point you start, all the albergues have these pilgrim passports that they hand out to you whenever you get there. And it has, like, you know, a very simple map of where you're going to go and the places you're going to pass through. I also have, this is a little booklet. I appreciated Paul's encouragement to not, term pilgrim and tourist in two different, you know, of a light, because you get all of these, which gives you everything of what to see, where to go, what has the good food, what has the albergues. So it's very touristy, but it's very helpful. And then, you know, when you get to the pilgrim site, I think they sign 100,000 Compostelas per year. And they can actually refuse signing your Compostela if you're unable to say that you did it for religious reasons. I don't know how often they do that, but they can. So there is that very, like, we want this to be religious for you, but we also want you to eat at all of our restaurants and stay in all the hotels. So, yeah. So you get your pilgrim passport, and that's also your proof of travel. You know, in order to get your Compostela, you get it stamped all the way through, and then you present it, and they make sure you have all of the, each stamp is different. If they see, like, you know, 100 kilometers gap between two stamps, they won't do it, you know? So they make sure that you travel the whole way. So.
Participation in pilgrimage in Europe is mushrooming. Ian Bradley reports that on the Camino, since 1980, the number of pilgrims has risen by more than fourfold. So in the last 20 years, it's 4 times as many participants as up until then. We have learned I had read it, and then from some Swedes who are with us at Iona, that every diocese of the Scandinavian Lutheran churches have pilgrimage pastors. So, for example, at the Cathedral of Trondheim, one of the routes that Bradley documents, that sadly we don't have pictures of, is the Walk to Trondheim, which would go through my ancestral stomping grounds, literally. And the ministry of the pastor is to minister to the flock that moves in front of him. I'm interested in the kind of ecclesiology that's operative there. And Bradley offers some really provocative questions about how interested we have become in getting people to join up, as rather than pay attention to each other, band together as you move along through life. As a campus pastor, I've appreciated reading that a lot.
It's a great way to think about my ministry because people keep moving in front of me. You know, that is the shape of my ministry. I think that's the shape of Holden's ministry, largely. It is a group of folks moving through. It's another kind of image of discipleship and an image of church that I think bears some thinking about. And the challenge is Americans who so quickly assume that because churches tend to be empty in Europe, that Christianity is dying. There is lots of fervor around lots of other practices. And we can learn from that. Any other questions about the pictures you've seen or the comments about the places you've been?
When we went to Iona, we were staying in Edinburgh, and it was kind of a, we knew that we didn't want to stay in the city for the rest of our, half of our week. And so we decided, well, do we go see the golf courses or we don't go to Iona? Golf courses, Iona, golf, oh, it wasn't much of a choice. And so we left at 7:30 in the morning and got there at 3:30 in the afternoon and stayed for 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
And then turned around and went back.
And did you see the golf course at Iona?
No, we didn't.
Too basic. Could have had a both-hand solution there.
Who knew? But it was worth it.
Well, we've said a few things about what pilgrimages are theologically and historically. Thursday, our session will be a workshop around the question, what are American pilgrimages? And so I'll bring some categories, for example, to help us think about landscapes. It seems to me that water and mountaintops, deserts, are often pilgrimage sites. Historical places are possibilities. And which would you name, and why would you name them? What does it mean to go there? What kinds of gifts, encounters do we expect out of those? Some cultural sites. We'll play it both ways. We'll think both in terms of the purposeful sort of travel and how and why that's important. And then maybe we'll think about other travel and what it says about our culture. So if the first two nominees are Disneyland and Las Vegas, what does that say about American culture that these be our pilgrimages? I think that'll be fun discussion. So, Thursday, same time, 3:45, on Meeting God on the Way, the United States. Thanks for coming.